Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Mr. Vindman, you testified in your deposition that you did not know the whistleblower.
Rank member, it's Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, please.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you testified in the deposition that you did not know who the whistleblower was or is.
I do not know who the whistleblower is. That is.
Well, how is it possible for you to name these people and then out the whistleblower?
Per the advice of my counsel, I've been advised not to answer specific questions about members of the intelligence community.
Are you aware that this is the intelligence committee that's conducting an impeachment hearing?
Of course I am.
Wouldn't the appropriate place for you to come to testify would be the intelligence committee about someone within the intelligence community?
Ranking member, per the advice of my counsel and the instructions from the chairman, I've been advised not to provide any specifics on who I have spoken to with inside the intelligence community. What I can offer is that these were properly cleared individuals, or was a properly cleared individual with a need to know.
All right, that was the voice that might be familiar. At least the circumstances should be close enough at hand that you should remember that that was Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who testified before the House Intelligence Committee about his knowledge of the phone call that President Trump made to the president of Ukraine. And then, of course, I think, again, I have trouble because the news is so thick, I can't remember which day. But it was just recently that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was marched out of the White House along with his twin brother. They both served on the National Security Council. And Vindman, of course, testified in uniform and said a lot of things. And I think the next person that we're going to introduce here might have some thoughts about this. He is a friend. You've heard him on this show with me before. His name is Rich Higgins. He's a senior fellow of Unconstrained Analytics. He's a counterterrorism expert. He himself served on the National Security Council under President Trump's National Security Council in 2017. And he himself was also marched out of the building under very different circumstances. Rich, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, Sandy. It's great to be back.
You know what? Let's set the stage for this because immediately when President Trump was elected, the Security Council was led by Michael Flynn, right?
Correct.
And you had been campaigning for the president because you liked his foreign policy, as I understand it.
Yes, I had started supporting him back in 2015.
And you thought that you were going to get a position on the National Security Council. Tell us about that.
Well, I ended up being offered initially a position to work the counterterrorism portfolio as a senior director, and then I ended up being pushed back by some of the resistance elements inside, both establishment Republican and Obama holdovers. So I ended up, after some debate, taking a more junior position because I ended up actually getting onto the Security Council the last week of February, maybe the first week of March of 2017. And I went in there knowing, it was a bureaucratic battle zone. And I wanted to see, how bad is it? What can I do to help? And it was far worse than I expected. I mean, what we now know is, a soft coup or a white coup is the technical term, was going on all around us. So after about, maybe 8-10 weeks, I wrote a memo with a couple of other folks, knowing that the National Security Council itself was compromised. I couldn't use the chain of command, and so I reached out to some of the people that I had served with during the actual campaign and wrote a memo to them, basically warning them, the now infamous POTUS and political warfare memo that was seeking to, let the president know, who was new to politics, that what he was experiencing was way outside the bounds of anything that, you'd see in a normal transition of power. When the president read it, allegedly, he never told me he read it, but I heard from people in the National Security Council who I maintained contact with, when the president read it, he liked it and had instructed McMaster to basically act upon it. And his idea of acting upon it was to, my feet didn't hit the ground. I basically, was thrown out of the National Security Council and out onto the street. And shortly after that, a couple of the guys who had been working with me to stop the coup Derek Harvey and Ezra Cohen were thrown out literally the following week. So I have some experience with the departure process.
Yes, you do, and I want to talk about that. But let's go back for a second, because some of this stuff we can't take for granted that people kind of are comprehending. When you say there was a coup or a counter move at the NSC, I think I would say that H.R. McMaster was part of that. And he was appointed after Lieutenant General Flynn was removed for all the reasons that we know and are still learning. So H.R. McMaster, is that true? Would you affirm that from your vantage point, H.R. McMaster was countermanding the president's wishes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you look at the removal of Flynn. I mean, yeah, you know, I know you're married to a former FBI agent. What would drive the FBI to doctor a 302, to have a lawyer, Lisa Page, review that 302 to ensure it met the legal standard for being a violation of the law, so that they could use that to remove Flynn, which they did. They also needed to remove Sessions. Now, you know, there's a lot out there about Flynn being removed because he was going to audit the intelligence community or something like that. I think that's just nonsense. It was a tactical decision as part of an operation that drove them to do that. They knew they needed to get the Attorney General out of there and the National Security Advisor out of there because they were two people in the chain of command that would have had oversight of the FISA and the surveillance. So those guys needed to be removed so that they could maintain spying on the president.
All right, so you've got two things, at least two things going on. You've got spying on the president, which pretty much you don't have to convince people of that now. By the way, I just talked to Cheryl Atkinson yesterday, speaking of being spied on, and they were employing the same tactics on her that they did on the president, but that's another story. So you have this spying on him, but you also have an undermining of his policies. And so describe that, Rich. What are we talking about?
I think, you know, the simplest way to describe it is the communications flow is inverted. You basically had the institutions telling the president what he could do. And General McMaster saw his job as taking from the institutions and then giving to the president what he was allowed to do, you know, the guardrails, if you will. Whereas, you know, in a normal relationship with your security advisor, you as the president are going to issue your commander's intent, and the National Security Advisor is then going to work with his staff to help drive that policy down into the interagency staff and the, you know, the various cabinet-level departments so as to be able to fulfill those objectives, which were, you know, which were the objectives voted upon by the American people. We didn't see that. Things like withdrawal from Afghanistan weren't really even seriously considered. And so, you know, there was a, you know, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, there were less than 10 people on the National Security Council that supported President Trump's agenda. And everybody else was either a partisan leftist remnant from the Obama administration, or, normal people just kind of watching the political fray go on around them, who tended to default to their institutional guidance. So we were fighting an uphill battle. You know, I famously described it to Bannon and Flynn during the period right after the election win that we were going into Omaha Beach, and they didn't believe me. You know, but I had served in both the Bush and Obama administrations. I knew how calcified the bureaucracy had become and what we were actually up against.
So there were lots of warnings to the president about McMaster. There were lots of people trying to get the word to him that he was being undermined in many, many, many ways. And the National Security Council was probably one of the worst most egregious examples. And yet McMaster stayed for a long time, but finally he was removed. I know the president, as far as I know, Rich, the president actually did read your memo, but this stuff kept happening. And so do you feel, I want to talk, I'm not through talking about this, but this is a question that occurs to me. Do you feel that the National Security Council has been reconfigured enough to actually do what the president wants it to do now, or to give him good advice, trustworthy advice?
I think Robert O'Brien has made a lot of, really, you know, net positive steps. I'm still concerned about, you know, about what's going on there. I still think it's too big. I mean, you know, John F. Kennedy went through the Cuban Missile Crisis with a National Security Council of 12 people. you know, it's just become this bloated bureaucratic thing that exists only under the executive office of the president. I mean, if the president wanted to, he could dissolve the National Security Council today with a memo. There's no legislative or statutory requirement to even keep it. So if it's not serving his interests, you know, and that may be the next step down the road. I think we all owe, you know, Robert O'Brien a chance to see if he can bring it in line. You know, certainly removing 70 people, you know, getting rid of the Venmans, you know, apparently they've ferreted out now anonymous. That's all good news and steps in the right direction, but it remains to be seen.
I'm curious, did you serve with the Venman brothers, or did they come later?
They came after me. They came in 2018. I think it's very odd that two brothers, both of Russian ethnic backgrounds, showed up there at the same time. I mean, their other brother was married in Moscow. Just a lot of weird stuff that's around them. I was talking to a security officer I know, and he had been stationed you know, in Eastern Europe and knew of Alexander Venman because he was a walking security violation. I'm told that he had 15 security violations in his 2 years when he was in Moscow. Now, if that's true, that's actually surreal because, you know, the normal State Department policy is 3 security violations and you're out. So there's a lot of weird stuff going with Mr. Venman, and, you know, that remains unexplained to this point.
Boy, it surely does. And was it McMaster? I don't know if you know this. I'm just curious if you do know who appointed him, the Venmans. Was it McMaster?
I don't know. I mean, I think McMaster was still there at the time. He came in around about the same time that Bolton came in. I'm just not sure, Sandy.
Yeah. All right. So now just a practical question. As Venman was testifying, and you were, I'm sure you're watching it in some form or fashion, Rich, he's sitting there in his uniform and he's talking about a presidential phone call, which is top secret, that he was assigned and tasked to listen to between another world leader. And he wrote some memo about it. As though it was the worst thing he'd ever heard. It was horrible. He was frightened. He was concerned. These are my words. I can't remember his words. He was, you know, in a turmoil. It was such a traumatic thing. And he rushed right to, to the whistleblower, who we believe is Eric Chiaramella. He did not go to his supervisors, as far as I know. Did you track all of that so that you could correct me or add to that conversation?
Right. I mean, Sandy, I'll simplify it for your listeners. It was an operation conducted against the president. Yeah, there were suspicions because this was, remember, the July phone call, the July 2019 phone call, was 3 months after the initial phone call with Zelensky when he won the election. And shortly after that first phone call with Zelensky, media leaks started coming about, you know, Trump was making deals with Zelensky and so on and so forth. But the roots of those stories never got, you know, they never actually got any traction. So then 3 months later, when this next phone call takes place, all of a sudden, you know, there is now a whistleblower, you know, the intelligence community, IG doctors, the form. You have Adam Schiff jumping on board, running this, you know, just shredding the Constitution in front of all of our eyes with the secret testimony and, you know, secret witnesses. And I mean, it was just unbelievable. I mean, they were doing to the Constitution and, you know, due process what Nancy Pelosi did to the State of the Union speech. I mean, they were literally just shredding it in front of our eyes. I couldn't believe watching it happen. But the point being, it was an operation from the very beginning by the same people who'd conducted the coup initially, primarily from the Department of Justice's National Security Division, and Mary McCord and Michael Atkinson and Chiaramella, all of whom were involved in the first phase of the coup, now found themselves involved in this part of the coup. Chiaramella is the Forrest Gump of all these events. I can't believe the way that the Republicans are playing this, to be honest with you. Eric Chiaramella was involved in the Ukraine. He was the National Security Council lead on the Biden thing. He was involved in the spying on the campaigns. He was suspect in leaking the presidential telephone transcripts. He was brought into the front office. He's cited in the Mueller report as being the source of the Putin directed the firing of Comey narrative in an email he sent to John Kelly in May of 2017. You know, after he finally departs the National Security Council, because the Mueller special counsel had been stood up, my belief, he thought he had done his job and Trump would be removed. When Mueller failed, okay, they had to go to option B being let's try and impeach him. So, you know, if you look at it from sort of a tradecraft operational perspective, it's very clear what's going on here. And unfortunately, to date, we just haven't seen the counterintelligence, counteroperational type response that's necessary.
Well, you just said something that really caught my ear because it's something I wanted to talk to you about. You say Chiaramella was briefing John Kelly, which morphs into this John Kelly finally letting loose on President Trump after having, you know, held his confidence. He was chief of staff. And he says Vindman was blameless and simply following the training he'd received. So now Vindman's connected to Eric Chiaramella. Now you say John Kelly was getting briefed by Eric Chiaramella. I'd like your comments about John Kelly's speech, his public statements now, and his potential involvement in this. Plus, Rich, I want to morph into something that's you've spent so much time tonight is the a debate in Las Vegas among the Democratic candidates. And you were the one tracking that horrible, brutal killing of 58 people at a concert and injury of several hundred others. And I want to talk a little bit about what you think happened there, if you don't mind. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk. Sandy Rios back with you. Rich Higgins is my guest. He's a senior fellow for Unconstrained Analytics. He's a counterterrorism expert. It's always fascinating to talk to Rich. And by the way, I did not say he has told his story in the Wall Street Journal. It's titled, "The White House Fired Me for My Loyalty." And we'll put that on our Facebook page so that you can refer to it and tell your friends what we're talking about today. Rich, before we go to the debates in Las Vegas and just Las Vegas and your background in investigating what happened there, I want to talk about John Kelly just for a second more. You know, he's the chief of staff. He's a former Marine general. And now he's, talking. Yeah, like talking. In fact, he said in this speech, it was a 75-minute speech, he said that Vindman is blameless and was simply following the training he'd received as a soldier. He said that he did exactly what we teach them to do from cradle to grave. He went and told his boss what he heard. He talks about when Vindman heard the president tell Zelensky he wanted to see the Biden family investigated, that was tantamount to hearing an illegal order, Kelly said. We teach them, don't follow an illegal order, and if you're ever given one, you'll raise it to whoever gives it to you that this is an illegal order, and then tell your boss. I just love to know your thoughts about Kelly speaking out like that and those statements.
All respect to General Kelly. You know, he lost his son in Afghanistan. I'm not going to question, his patriotism, but I have to question his politics here. I mean, anytime somebody uses words like blameless, and absolutes like that, I immediately, begin to question their motives. He's stating some untruths there. Number one, he did not tell his boss or use the chain of command. That was one of the major issues that his direct supervisor complained about under oath. We have all seen the transcript, even if it was alluded to that the president did hope to have an investigation opened on Biden, perhaps it was because he knew how corrupt Biden actually was. And the irony is not lost on me that, Joe Biden is now carrying the corrupt bag for the Democrats and Hillary Clinton, the El Chapo of corruption, it continues to just skate on by. I think there's a lot going on behind the scenes here. I think General Kelly has to elaborate a little bit more fully on specifically in Section 2 of the Mueller report, footnote 468, which shows that Eric Chiaramella was communicating with General Kelly when he was the Secretary of Homeland Security about meetings in the Oval Office. That is highly unusual and certainly outside the chain of command. And it appears to be, at least from the footnote, where the Putin directed the firing of Comey narrative was originally born. And we saw what that put the country through. I think there are a lot of people who have sort of these glass houses and these icons of, generals and these institutions like the FBI. And we just have to, take at face value that we have been collectively betrayed. And, salvaging the institutions, maybe not salvaging the institutions, we have to be open-minded about the solution or the solutions to, problems of this magnitude.
Yes, and that's why I think at least there's some encouragement in the president beginning to clean house a bit. And finally, honestly, Rich, I think you would agree to have him finally listening to people that are actually his friends about the people around him who are not serving him well. It's taken a long time to get that message to the president. He's been actually very forgiving, too forgiving, and a lot of damage has been done. So anyway, I want to transfer the conversation just for a second. I think it's ironic that that you're my guest today and that the debate tonight for the Democrats is taking place in Las Vegas. And Las Vegas, of course, conjures up a horrible event that happened there in October of 2017 when a shooter known as Stephen Paddock, rented a room in a high-rise hotel and opened fire and murdered 58 people what's called the Route 91 Country Music Festival. And, Rich, as a result of that, I'll just say what public people know. I would say this. We know that most of the people there, it was a country western concert, were conservatives, probably politically. And we also know that Stephen Paddock, suddenly the investigation went silent. It went silent for weeks and months, maybe even a year. They kept telling us they didn't know hardly anything, and they would eke out bits of information. You, as a counterterrorism expert, and others have worked really hard to try to figure out what actually happened there, since the FBI doesn't seem to be willing to tell us. And if I'm wrong about that, if the FBI has come in with a logical explanation and I missed it, please correct me. But then if I'm not wrong, then tell us what kind of, in a synopsis, what you found and what you think might have transpired.
Well, I think the most important thing for your listeners to know is that there are still good guys in the FBI. And, they're repressed. They're certainly not selected for promotion past the GS 14-15 level. In a nutshell, I don't know if you recall Senator Johnson up on the Senate Homeland Security Committee talking about the FBI having a quote-unquote secret society inside of it. And while that may be a poor word choice, he was right. I mean, it was a small secret group that was meeting off-site or coordinating over Skype that was participant in A, trying to stop Trump, and B, trying to remove him after he'd been elected to office. And a lot of the names in that group are, you know, names people know, the lawyer, Jim Baker, McCabe, Lisa Page, Peter Strzok. But one of the names on that group was a guy named Aaron Rouse. And what's interesting about Aaron Rouse is he had worked in counterintelligence with Peter Strzok and Andy McCabe, but he was the special agent in charge of the Las Vegas office of the FBI when the attack happened. The most interesting thing about the attack itself is that the FBI basically said this isn't terrorism, and they left it to the Las Vegas police to kind of deal with what they found. The dead guy in the room, the 58 people laying dead on the field. Kind of case closed. Despite the fact that ISIS had issued in the summer prior to the attack two warnings that they were going to attack Las Vegas, and despite the fact that after the attack, ISIS claimed it four times. And, oddly, the Antifa group out of Melbourne, Australia, also claimed the attack. Doing some basic research with other guys I know across the counterterrorism community, we just started monitoring open source information. And we found some very, suspicious individuals who had been in Las Vegas at the time of the attack. And some of them had conducted interviews on television in Australia, closely affiliated with leftist causes, never were even interviewed by the FBI, despite public statements claiming they were on the 32nd floor at the time of the attack, had snuck out through a kitchen, hid for 3.5 hours, but then disappeared for 5 days on social media. And these are individuals that are, currently loose inside the United States and still have not been interviewed by the FBI. It's really a remarkable sequence of events. There was some debate as to, he just won an attack and it's really about the weapons. In counterterrorism, one of the absolute truths, and I've done counterterrorism for almost 30 years, Sandy. It's kind of like the cops. In the target is the motive. And it was military and police appreciation night at the end of a 3 or 4 day country music festival in the town of Trump's largest donors, Sheldon Adelson and Steve Wynn, who'd been the RNC finance guy. You know, if it walks like a duck, it's quite clear to me what that was.
Well, now you have...
go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to point, this is from a layman's perspective, Steve, because you know so much. Rich, I was just reading Stephen Paddock's name. Rich, you know so much that sometimes maybe it's hard to step back, but from an obvious perspective, just the silence, the quick declaration that it was not terrorism was such a red flag to me. And then the silence over Stephen Paddock, the mystery, the inability to find out very much about him, how things were just shut down. There were just some blatant holes.
Well, two other data points to your listeners. One is that the FBI, you know, normally a field office would control an investigation like that, or, you know, and if additional resources were required, for example, it had been an ISIS attack, you know, headquarters in Washington would surge additional resources into the area. You didn't see that happen in this case, except for the forensic evidence recovery team. The other thing that's interesting is the immediate actions after the attack were to have operational control of the response brought up to the seventh floor at the Hoover Building in Washington, D.C., which is highly unusual. And you find yourself asking, what is going on here? And again, the absolute silence from Congress, the absolute silence and oversight. And then 2 or 3 weeks ago, I saw it was picked up by, I believe, the New York Post. Stephen Paddock's girlfriend, the one who, you know, he'd given money and sent off to the Philippines or whatnot. Now, recall, she's also Australian. She was arrested in New Zealand carrying a fake weapon. And it just blurped up on the radar screen quickly and then went back underground. But it's very important to note, like, the Australian Antifa connection to the Vegas attack. And one of the principal suspects that you know, I would say is certainly a person of interest, if not an outright suspect, is from Melbourne, Australia. Arlu Danley is from Australia. There's just a lot of loose ends that haven't been investigated. I'm not saying I know what happened. I'm saying nobody knows what happened.
Because why don't we know? And I'm asking, why don't we know? You know, why don't we know? Why didn't they get to the bottom? That was a horrific killing, a slaughter. And why weren't the powers that be more concerned? And you know, Rich, I think the other incriminating thing is that somewhere around that time, and I'm sorry I don't have the date in front of me, there was that attempted mass shooting in Alexandria, Virginia, of the Republican congressman. Steve Scalise was nearly mortally wounded. Everyone will remember that, I hope, although it didn't really get all that much press. The FBI did a press conference after that, after they'd come to their conclusion. And I watched that live, Rich. I'll never forget it. And the agent in charge was so very smug and assured us that, you know, maybe there was some problems at home with the shooter. We can't possibly know motive. And he was very arrogant and very dismissive. And many of us just knew. I mean, the guy was a Bernie supporter. And I think there was evidence that there was some political motive. It was a Republican event, after all. And he'd ask, you know, one of the Republican congressmen in the parking lot, are these Republicans? And yet nothing was made of that. So there was this climate of distrust, I'll say, for me toward the FBI, was the way the FBI was handling a lot of things, not the least of which was the president's matters and affairs. So I think that's another contaminating fact. Well, are you still working on this? You have done a long paper. By the way, can we post that on our Facebook page, your kind of blue, your treatise on what might have happened there?
Let me make sure. Yeah, I just want to make sure there's nothing personal information or anything in there. I don't want to give phone numbers and stuff with people, but sure.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, we'll wait till you check that out. But it's fascinating, and if some of you have had your curiosity aroused and you really want to know more about what Rich has to say about that, it is a fascinating read. So, Rich, are you feeling optimistic at this time about the way the country's going, or where are the danger points now from your perspective?
I have to be honest with you. I think President Trump is doing a fantastic job. He is rightly recognizing that the Democrat Party has fully embraced Marxist-Leninism. You have Bernie Sanders, an open Trotskyite, leading the ticket. You have Pete Buttigieg, who is a Gramsci Marxist, whose father was the head of the International Gramsci Society. You know, you have Bloomberg, who is basically a Chinese agent for all intents and purposes, and that's their party today. They are the Communist Party of the United States. Donald Trump recognizes that, and he's creating the big tent, and you see rallies where, you know, 175,000 people are trying to come to political rallies. It tells me that the MAGA movement is transcendent, and it's bigger than Trump. So I think he's done a very good job of helping build back America's sense of itself. I'm concerned by how the state, and the people that are aligned with the coup and just the hate America crowd is going to react. I anticipate more violence.
Yep.
I anticipate traps. And I think the president has done that. I don't know what happened in the past month or two with the president, maybe the impeachment ending, but even before that, he is on message, not just president from a political standpoint. He's on message and he's making these personnel decisions that, candidly, we've been waiting for 2 or 3 years.
I know, Rich, I have to interrupt you. I have to interrupt you because we're ending. But interesting, a great ending, encouraging. And thank you, Rich, for all that you've done to serve this country. Rich Higgins, Senior Fellow, Unconstrained Analytics. Sandy Rios in the Morning, AFR Talk.